Today we are finishing up a series we have been in the book of Hebrews, or I've referred to it often as the Sermon to the Hebrews, written as this. So we've been studying and learning about this story that tells, or this letter, this sermon that talks about who Jesus is, particularly using the image of Jesus as the great high priest. But one of the primary images or calls in Hebrews is to keep our eyes fixed on Jesus as we run the race, as we live this life of faith. An important part of that is looking to Jesus as our example, and also staying fixed and attached to him because he's the only one who can bring us through. It was a letter, a sermon written to a group of people who were probably discouraged. They were struggling in their faith, maybe facing persecution, maybe having doubts. Maybe they were worried, and maybe they were drifting a little bit in what they believed. And so this letter, this sermon was sent to them to encourage them to keep their eyes fixed on Jesus and to come and to run the race that was set before them, to throw off all the entanglements, the things that were dragging them down, to run, to live by faith, to trust in the faithful one, this faithful one who's described as the great high priest. So we come now to the last chapter, what we call the last chapter. Again, chapters and verses were something added much later. And as we get to this section, this chapter of the Bible, chapter of Hebrews, we find it's not as full of the rich imagery. Earlier on, there were all these things. There were sacrifices and Melchizedek the priest and all these images that were hard for us to understand. The last part, for the most part, becomes relatively simple. It's a much more straightforward. There was a little section in the middle there about being outside the camp and the blood and the altar. We're not going to get into that today. But it also seems to lack some of that soaring rhetoric of earlier in the letter. And the ending also reminds us in part that it is a letter. In the very end, we get the section about greet all your leaders and all the Lord's people. So whoever wrote this wasn't able to deliver it in person. They weren't able to deliver it in the sermon, but they were instead gave it to someone else to read to the congregation, wherever they were. And then it ends as a letter often ends. And in the conclusion, what it does is talk about these final thoughts on the life of faith, what it looks like to remain faithful. And so I want to look today at a few of these words of instruction, words of wisdom, and in particular, pay attention to five of those commands that were given to the people, or five words of encouragement, I would say. But first, before we look at those five, I want to pay attention to some connective tissue, some things that put all these together, or maybe we could call a foundation as we consider all these things that we need to keep in the back of our mind, or maybe even in the front of our mind as we read through these five. The first is that very last verse, the final words of the book of Hebrews. Grace be with you all. And it reminds us that grace is a gift from God. Grace is more than forgiveness. Grace is what empowers us to live. It's a call to live a faithful life. So even as we hear the commands, as we hear these calls to be faithful, we're reminded that we're not saved by those things we do, but we're said saved by grace. But that grace also encourages us to live a faithful life and live in dependence on the one who is faithful. The other foundational part is this in chapter 13, verse 14. For we do not have an enduring city, but we are looking for the city that is to come. It's a reminder that the world they currently know does not offer an abiding city for them. It's a reminder that for these people and for us, this is not our final destination. This is not our enduring place, but there's somewhere else we're looking forward to. It's a reminder that we're in some sense strangers and pilgrims, which also reminds us that we are somewhat of outsiders, that we don't completely fit in. And so we'll talk a little bit about that as we're looking at these. And so to follow Jesus, to live a life of faith may mean they get put out. And that was referenced in verse 13. Where it said, let us then go to him outside the camp, bearing the disgrace he bore. In other words, Jesus, in his ministry, he ended up disgraced, shamed as he was hung on a cross, part of the crucifixion that the Romans did oftentimes to slaves, to rebels, was not merely to execute someone. You could execute someone much more swiftly, much more quickly than hanging them on a cross. Hanging them on a cross did two things. One, it reminded people of what happened to those who rebelled against the power of Rome. So we often have a picture of the cross way up on a hill, and it was likely on somewhat of a rise, but most of the time when people were crucified, they were crucified nearly at eye level. So anyone entering into the city was looking in the face of the person being crucified. And they were crucified in a way that brought shame upon them. And so there was this disgrace that was brought on them. And so in the same way Jesus suffered, we're called also to remind us that sometimes following him, sometimes that picture of taking up the cross means we can suffer shame. We can just suffer disgrace. We can sometimes be put outside the city. That our home is with God and we may not fit in. And so David Bentley Hart refers to this in an article he calls titled No Enduring City, drawn from the Hebrews 13, 14. And he tells a story in from Italy in 1236. And the capital city of Italy at the time, Bologna, set free nearly 6,000 serfs, 6,000 bonded servants within the city. What happened was they read the scripture and they saw how God had set us free in Jesus Christ from bondage to death and to sin. And that by Christ's dignity, all of us should have our natural liberty restored. And so he looked at this and this is what he said about it. He said, it was an altogether radical proclamation of an intrinsic incompatibility between the concrete realities of the prevailing social order and the language of the gospel that Christian society professed to obey. Notice that. He says there's an intrinsic incompatibility between the social order. The social order said that it was okay to put people in slavery. And the people of the city read the scripture and said, what we do here in society does not match up with what the gospel, the good news of Jesus proclaims. There's a radical incompatibility, intrinsic compatibility, and we can't live that way. And that's part of what the writer to the Hebrews is getting at, is there is often an incompatibility between the gospel of Jesus Christ and the prevailing social order. It takes all different shapes and forms, but what we grow up with, what we take in through movies, through television, through reading, through newspapers, through all sorts of ways, are not always compatible with the gospel of Jesus Christ. And by the gospel, we don't simply mean we're talking about his life, death, and resurrection, but all that Jesus proclaims, all that he represents, all that he stands for. And so for the people who received the letter to the Hebrews, there were economic and social implications, difficulties and challenges. As they chose to follow Jesus, it meant things in their life. But they saw that the good news of Jesus demanded following him. And it may call us also to go against the social order. It may call us to go against culture. It may call us to go against the government. It may call us to go against family and friends. But it calls us to a different way of life. And so I want to look at five of the commands briefly that are offered in this opening section of chapter 13, and consider those. And ask, how can we as individuals and as a community live them out? So first, chapter 13, verse 1, keep on loving one another as brothers and sisters. So remember again, he's writing to a church. It's a sermon written to a congregation of people of following Jesus. And notice, it says, keep on loving one another. There's a sense where they're already doing this. In other words, they're called to persevere in this. And the language of brothers and sisters comes from even earlier in the book of Hebrews and all throughout most of the New Testament, where Jesus is referred to as our brother. He's the one who's the example. And so here we can think of the words and actions maybe that promote mature living. And so loving one another takes all different forms, doesn't it? It may take the form of recognizing that we're not all in the same place, that we don't all agree on everything, and so we find ways to love one another, to persist through the differences. A number of years ago as a congregation, we developed something called the Covenant for Christian Community or Covenant for Christian Living, and there's a copy of it in our what we call our conference room. So if you exit the sanctuary and go to the left, and go to the little entryway, there's the coffee stand, and there's a large classroom there, and on the wall is a copy of that. And it talks about what it looks like to live a life of radical love with one another. Sometimes it's forgiving one another. Sometimes it's when we have a difference with someone, going to that person and speaking to them about it, taking it face to face. One of the other lines is recognize that we're not all in our same place in our walk with Jesus. that we're all in different stages of faith. And the strange and wonderful and amazing thing about the life of faith is someone who is at 1 year and someone who is at 40 years of following Jesus are going to be in different places. And the person at 40 years may not always be ahead in everything that the person in 1 year is. Hopefully they're farther ahead in most things and they're generally ahead, but sometimes somebody in their first year is at a different place. And it's to recognize we're all at different places. And it's not our place to decide, but our role is to encourage them, to walk beside them. And we spent a number of weeks ago looked at a lot more of that. But what it looks like to say, love sometimes means encouraging someone coming alongside someone, encouraging them in their walk of faith, helping them to love Jesus more, helping them to love their neighbors more. And to recognize that when we talk about church and loving one another, it's not just within these four walls right here. It's not just when we're sitting in the pews. Our love for one another might take place out in the narthex. Our love for one another might take place down in the gym when we're eating a meal together. It might happen out in the parking lot. It might happen outside of these walls. But it's a call to love one another. It isn't as if when we walk in the doors on Sunday morning, all of a sudden, I say, well, now I've got to love you. But once we exit those doors, hey, gloves are off. We can go ahead. No, this is a love for one another at all times. But the love for one another that he speaks of is not just for those we know. And so at verse 2 of chapter 13, do not forget to show hospitality to strangers. For by doing so, some people have shown hospitality to angels without knowing it. So it's this picture of saying that while we care for the family and those who are close to us, that can sometimes be easy to do. Sometimes it can be hard, but sometimes it can be easy to do. But in the process of doing that, of loving those close to us, we might forget those or ignore the people far away. And so we realize God doesn't forget. That we're called to live out the faithfulness as we are strangers. As we look around and say, we're called to love the people we don't know so well. To show hospitality, to welcome them in some ways. And so I like the way Amy Peeler says it. She says, every Christian really lives as a stranger. And so that goes back to that picture of we all are strangers and pilgrims on the earth. And so loving someone you do not know is made easier by the reminder that you share the same mode of existence on earth. In other words, when we remember that we are strangers too, we find someone who's a stranger to us and realize we're in some ways the same way. We're in some ways the same kind of people. We're both strangers, and so it enables us to love them as different. And so loving someone you do not know is made easier by the reminder that you share the same mode of existence on earth. And part of the way we do that is to recognize the inherent dignity of each person, to recognize that each person we meet, everyone we meet is created in the image of God. Everyone we meet is an image bearer. Everyone deserves dignity. And so there's a very famous quote from C.S. Lewis, a long section in his essay called The Weight of Glory. And so I want to read a little bit of that. And he says this, it is a serious thing to live in a society of possible gods and goddesses. And he's talking about just that we are infused with the divine. He's not implying that we're gods. We sometimes think gods, but there is a divinity in us. In a sense, a spark of who God is. To remember that the dullest and most uninteresting person you talk to may one day be a creature, which if you saw it now, you would be strongly tempted to worship. He talks about the way we're transformed by who Jesus is. And then he says, or else a horror and a corruption such as you now meet, if at all, only in a nightmare. And then this line, he says, there are no ordinary people. You have never talked to a mere mortal. And then as a Catholic, he goes on, he says, next to the Blessed Sacrament itself, your neighbor is the holiest object presented to your senses. Think about that. Do we consider our neighbors as holy, as somehow infused with who God is? When we think back to the opening words of Scripture, when it says, in the image of God, he created the man and woman, he created them. God created each one of us in his image. So in some sense, there is a bit of the divine in each one of us. Again, not saying we are gods. There's kind of all distortions of that. But to remember, when we meet someone on the street, when we're checking out at the grocery store, When we're walking down the street and we see the person holding up the sign on the street corner. When we're at work and we're dealing with our boss or someone who works for us. When we're at school and we're dealing with someone in the classroom. Do we recognize that they are a person with inherent dignity? That they are someone who is created in the image of God and thus deserve a certain way of being treated? And so I think this is important, and especially as we consider the next part of the call. And so he's moving on from strangers and goes on and says, continue to remember those in prison as if you were together with them in prison, and those who are mistreated as if you yourselves were suffering. And this connects to that, this picture of, do we treat the prisoners? How do we treat those who are suffering as someone with inherent dignity? And this is not to say we ignore crimes. It's not to say that someone who has committed a crime doesn't necessarily deserve, if we use the words, to be in jail. But it's to say, well, they also at the same time deserve to be treated with dignity and with respect and treated as humans, which means we don't refer to them as vermin or rats. We don't use language that dehumanizes people in any shape or form. We don't use prisoners as a prop for political purposes, but instead we treat them as people deserving of dignity and respect. Again, not ignoring anything and saying, okay, this, they committed a crime and the jail is the rightful, is the place we keep them as a society, but it does not make them less than human. They continue to be human beings deserving of dignity. And so we go and we go and we visit them. We understand their story. A couple of years ago, our family did a trip down south, and we toured a number of sites of the civil rights movement. And one of the places we visited was the Legacy Museum, a museum created as a part of the Equal Justice Initiative. Bryan Stevenson, who wrote the book Just Mercy and the movie that was made from that, created this. And it's a museum that traces the history from slavery to modern-day incarceration. And one of the displays had this power. There was a powerful display near the very end of it where you could sit as if you were sitting across from someone. I know if you've ever visited someone in jail and you sit down at the little thing and there's the little window and you can talk to the person. If you've never done it yourself, you've at least seen it on television. You've got a picture of what this idea is. But what they had done at the Legacy Museum was they had videoed people who were in jail and had them speaking. And so you sat down and then using technology, they projected them on this glass screen so it was as if you were talking to them or hearing them talk to you. They didn't respond to you. It was just a video recording of them talking to you. But you could hear these stories, and as you heard their stories of them being in jail, you were reminded that, yes, they were in an orange jumpsuit. Yes, they were in jail, and many of them had done horrible crimes. Some had not. But they were still a human being deserving of dignity and deserving of respect. And so I think when the writer of Hebrews says this and talks about the call to visit those in jail, it's a reminder in part to remember those who are often forgotten. I mean, I'll give it to you. I go through many weeks and I don't necessarily think about there's people in jail. In the United States, hundreds of thousands of people in jail. But to remember them and to remember that they too are people and deserving of our dignity, and deserving of our respect. And there are people who are called to that ministry, to go and to regularly visit in jail, but consider what it is you can do and how you can think about those who are in jail or those who are mistreated. And then he moves on to this. It says, marriage should be honored by all, and the marriage bed kept pure, for God will judge the adulterer and all the sexually immoral. And in some sense, this is a statement about all of sexuality. It's a reminder that the way we use our bodies makes a difference. And again, here we're running very much, like many of these things, counter to culture around us, to live in different ways. We're fighting against the norms. We're fighting against the norm here where the writer is reminding us that the only place for sex is within the confines of a marriage between a man and a woman. But we're also talking in a modern society where something like pornography has been in many ways normalized. Or pornography, which is this online presentation or videos or books which portray sexuality as someone, and it portrays, again, a lack of dignity, because then the other person, the man, the woman in the video, in the magazine, becomes someone simply to be used for our own pleasure. They're no longer a human being. They're simply an object. And when I think about the ways in which it's been normalized, and again, those words of David Bentley Hart about going against the intrinsic compatibility of the gospel with the prevailing social norms, I found a few statistics. And one of those two that I want to highlight was in a recent survey, of people in the United States, it talked about the comparison, and it asked a number of teens and young adults, so ages 13 to 24, about a variety of issues and how they ranked them as like bad, very bad, and different things. And one of the interesting statistics that came out of that was that for that particular age group, in this study done, that they ranked overeating as more immoral than watching pornography. But it's not to pick on just young folks here, but to say, and so if we looked at nationwide, about one in two adults, those 25 and over, do not consider viewing pornography as morally wrong. So one in two adults. And I know there's probably some of us, if statistics are right, there are some of us in here who view pornography. There are some of us who may struggle with the pornography. And so this isn't a point in your face and tell you how terrible you are. But it's a reminder that often what we do is fighting against the prevailing norms of culture. And so when the writer, the preacher in Hebrews says, this is what it looks like to follow Jesus, it's a different life in our sexual ethic, we're fighting upstream in many ways. And so we battle against that. Final one to think on. We had sex, now what do we get to talk about? Money. All right. Keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have, because God has said, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. And so the call is a freedom from money and the love of comfort. And so for this original church, there was a danger when they were confessing Jesus Christ that they could lose their jobs. That because they did not follow Jesus, they might not be allowed to be a part of a trade guild and would have struggles financially. Now for us, we may not face the same sort of economic persecution. It may not be prominent, but what we have to consider is what is called normal when it comes to the uses of our finances. What should we participate in? How do we benefit from the mistreatment of others? And this is a challenging thing, and one of the interesting things is I've found over the years of being in church and being in small groups and discussing with people that there are a lot of topics we feel comfortable discussing, but money's not usually one of them. You can sit in a group and people talk about maybe their marriage struggles or their anger issues or their lust issues or whatever it is, but rarely in a group of folks, Christians sitting around, does anybody talk about their money. Part because sometimes money is a sneaky and tricky thing. Most of us wouldn't consider ourselves wealthy. And so we think, I don't have a problem with money. But here is what he's talking about and getting at is this picture, and again, read the verses, keep your lives free from the love of money. In what ways are we shaped and molded by a desire for money? In what ways do we see money as potentially the way that will solve all of our problems? That if we just had a little bit more, if I just had a little bit more, then I'd be comfortable. If I had a little bit more in my retirement account, if I had a little bit more in my checking account, if I had a retirement account, I would be happy and I would be content and I would feel safe and secure, which is why it says, because God has said, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. It's a reminder that God will not leave you, God will not forsake you, but money will. Money will not keep you secure. And it's a way to maybe think about how do we use money? How do we think about money? How do we think about the way we spend and the way we spend money and how it affects others and the wise use of our money? And how do we benefit from the treatment of others? And so it talks about contentment as a cure, where it says, and be content with what you have. I recognize that I don't need more. I can be content with what I have. And for a number of years, I think about in the United States in particular, simplicity has become kind of an aesthetic, if you will. You know, there's a magazine, Real Simple, and Simple Living, although you look at some of the Simple Living and people are still living with a whole lot of really expensive stuff to live a simple life. Simple Living is not an aesthetic, but a demonstration of dependence on God. It's to say, I don't need one more of this. I don't need five more of these, but I can be content with what I have. And it's practicing, for some people, it's maybe taking a journal and looking around and saying, oh, I'm okay with these things I have. Maybe it's taking an inventory in your closet or whatever particular, maybe it's for some, it's your closet. Maybe some of you, it's your shop or your shed, and you're looking through and say, how many of this particular item do I need? Or when was the last time I used this particular item? And for many of us, it's the, but I might someday, right? Very true. And it's no, there's no right nor wrong answer for any of us. The Bible doesn't say if you haven't used it in 6 months, get rid of it. But what it does say is, are you content with what you have, and to not get caught up in thinking that the items that you have, that the money that you have will make you content, or those items will keep you secure. And so he's talking about this idea of being fixed on Jesus and saying, Jesus is the only one who can secure our future. Jesus is the only one who provides ultimate, guaranteed, lasting security. It's not a Roth IRA, it's not a 401k, it's not our investment in classic cars or toys, whatever it is, it's Jesus and him alone. And so it's a reminder that we are called to demonstrate a dependence on God. And so the final words in the book of Hebrews, they're lasting words, they're enduring words. They're not simply words written to a congregation 2,000 years ago, but words we can invite and hear for ourselves, that we're invited by Jesus. We're invited by Jesus to be empowered by his grace. The grace that saved us, the grace that enables us to live, to not do these things on our own, to love the stranger, to love the prisoner, to free ourselves from money is not something we can do through our own power, but only through the power and the Spirit of God working inside of us, only through the grace of God. And so if one of these is a struggle, if it's a struggle to love the people in the congregation, if it's a struggle to show hospitality to strangers, if it's a struggle to think of people in prison as people with dignity and respect, if it's a struggle to keep marriage bed pure, to remain sexually pure in some ways, if it's a struggle to be free from the love of money, go to God and ask him, because you cannot do it on your own. So it's a call to live empowered by his grace, to live this life of faith, and to remember that we are strangers, we are pilgrims, and we have no enduring city here, but we do have an enduring king. And he calls us to follow him. Amen.